Thanks to technology, the banking landscape is completely and rapidly changing. These changes have been even further accelerated by the pandemic. How can smaller banks keep up? How do we empower underserved communities to utilize the newly increased access to financial resources? And how is the National Bankers Association addressing these questions? Hey, it's Kirsten. Welcome to the fifth episode of FinTech Study Hall, Season 2. Today, we're taking a look at the banking landscape with Nicole Elam, the president and CEO of the National Bankers Association. Let's dive in. There's such few women in these positions of CEO, so it's so delighted to have you as a woman and a woman of color. Just amazing. So exciting. Tell me a little bit about the mission of National Bankers Association and your path to this role.
So the National Bankers Association is a 95-year-old trade association that represents minority-owned and operated banks, or called MDIs, Minority Depository Institutions. These are banks that are Black, Brown, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, and even women-owned and operated banks. What makes these banks so unique is that these are banks that were really born out of racism because Black, Brown, and immigrant communities could not go to mainstream financial institutions for their banking services. And the unfortunate reality is that that is still the case today, where you see a lot of unmet needs. And so these banks are really at the center of helping to close the racial wealth gap by providing mortgages, small business loans, and access to financial services to communities that are underserved by mainstream financial institutions. And so my role and my path, rather, to the National Bankers Association was certainly not one that I planned. I started my career 20 years ago in civil rights. Now, I ended up at Akin Gump when the market crashed doing congressional investigations. But my last place was at JPMorgan Chase, where I was in their government relations department. So it's really nice to kind of see this intersection of you know, just banking and focused on equity. It's a great place to be.
I love it. And I think that access to capital is a civil rights issue. And I talked to women in like the Me Too movement about amplifying that, not just looking at wage gap and access to capital, but even, you know, like how do you empower different communities to have the technological capability to catch up, to keep up, to innovate, and to compete? Now, with your eye to technology this year, how are the different community banks and MDIs working to leverage technology to stay a step ahead of the curve?
Yeah, so technology is really driving everything. And we learned that during the pandemic. Our banks that had technology were able to push out more PPP loans. They were able to keep their virtual doors open. And just that the banking landscape is completely changing, and it was accelerated by the pandemic. The challenge is that technology is so expensive. If you are a small bank, it costs a lot of money to have technology, and you have to have people in place to help you implement that technology. And so when I think about some of my former employer, they're spending $11 billion a year on technology alone and on innovation. That's just not something that my banks are able to do. And so what we're doing at the National Bankers Association is really trying to be intentional about how can we help our banks compete so they don't get left behind? How can we address the issues of how costly technology is? How can we address the issue of how sometimes they don't have that in-house capacity? How can we address the issue of core integration? Because many of them are reliant on their core providers to help them with catching up with digitization. And so we're trying to do as much as we can to centralize some of those concerns. And recently, we actually received a $10 million grant on our nonprofit side, on the National Bankers Community Alliance, from the City Foundation. And we are so excited about that. What they recognize is how important it is for these community banks to help to modernize, digitize, and scale. And so they're giving us dollars to, one, help our banks have digitization roadmaps, identify their tech step, how do they get from where they are to where they want to be. But then also, how can we build or buy a technology solution that can help a lot of our member banks? And so we're really excited about that.
I have, you know, heard people talk about how even the process of going into a bank traditionally with like the Greek columns and the kind of imposing architecture of it was in a way a roadblock to some people even wanting to step foot. So digitization kind of brings the banking into people's, you know, whether they're on their iPad or their phone from their They could be in their closet, in their bathroom, in their kitchen. It just brings it home that you don't have to go through that whole process of actually going into the brick and mortar, which seems like very exciting and also like a huge undertaking to make that digitization happen.
Yeah, it certainly makes it more accessible. Technology should make the access to and the affordability of financial services better.
And I think on, you know, I obviously focus very much on the capital markets front. So that really resonates. Like over the past three decades, I look at what was, you know, the stock trading floors, right? It was mostly men in the pictures in the 80s on the trading floors, the specialists. And now you see that transformed electronically, that anyone can trade from their iPad or their iPhone through electronic intermediaries. And that has brought down the cost. That digitization has brought down the cost. Think of trading from like, it was like 50 basis points to just a, you know, what used to be $6 to trade $100 is now like a fraction of a penny. So brought in so much excitement as far as just being able to trade without losing your first $6 out of 100. So that has opened the doors to more women and people of color as well to
absolutely
the system. And so it's really exciting, and it's all interconnected, right?
Like it is
stock trading, and then also, you know, whether it's your mortgage or capital for a business, that digitization is exciting, but it also comes, I think, with a lot of need for, you know, I guess working together with different market participants and different banks to collectivize, right? Like the $10 million you receive will help a lot of banks make a lot of progress, it sounds.
Yep. Collaboration. Collaboration is going to help them with collaboration and scale. And so really excited about just how this opens the doors for these banks.
What do you see? Are there any key trends shaping up for 2023 on digitization? Or even, I know like a couple years ago, a lot of the ATMs changed to express ATMs to try to rethink the banking system. Is there some new trend you're seeing for 2023? Or is it a continuation of what started during the pandemic?
Yeah, so many trends. You know, there's this big picture trend around just how the landscape is changing so much. You know, the reality of it is that there are a lot of challenges. When you think about 2023, there's this uncertain economy. You've got heightened interest rates. You've got increased cost of lending. All of these things are happening. But I think it provides a great opportunity for banks to pivot and build more momentum and provide maybe a unique, high quality customer experience. The interesting thing is that our customer demographic is changing, right? The younger customer base is quickly becoming the majority customer. And so how you serve them is very different. You have to be able to meet customers where they are. The way that people bank is different. The way that people shop is different. The way that people spend and do life is different. And all of that is undergirded by technology. And so I think this really provides an opportunity for our banks to expand their digital solutions, both internally, but also external facing, so that they can meet these customers where they are and better leverage technology. I also think another trend is around industry fragmentation, right? The way that people are getting access to banking services is totally different. And so banks have got to extend their products and services beyond the traditional channels. They're going to have to drive better customer segmentation. And how do they meet this particular customer? They're going to have to increase their non-interest revenue. They're going to have to foster a streamless customer experience. So many things are changing around the way that people do business. Now, this whole idea of branches, right? That in and of itself is a whole different dynamic. During the pandemic, the branches closed at a rate that was 2x, right? It doubled during the pandemic. And unfortunately, the communities that were the hardest hit were the low to moderate income communities, the rural communities, and the minority neighborhoods were hit the hardest. But this trend of kind of changing branches and lowering your physical branch presence is something that was a trend that was already happening, but it was certainly accelerated during the pandemic. And so it really goes to show that maybe the role of the branches is changing and what the branches look like is also changing. I don't know if you've noticed this, but you know, it used to be that branches had these tellers, right? That you come in, you walk up to a teller, you talk to the teller. All of that is completely shifting. You're seeing more community branches where it's more open space, and this space is available for the community to use for maybe a pop-up shop for small businesses or financial wellness programs. So they're really changing it. You've seen cafes, right? Where there's these cafes where it's all about the community gathering, and banking is something that you can also do. There are less tellers, but more people who are financial advisors. So you walk in and they're basically trying to show you how to use an iPad. to conduct your banking business. So the branches are changing. But unfortunately, there's still a huge need because you've got less tech savvy and lower income communities that are still more reliant on physical branches than other communities. And so you've got to be very thoughtful and mindful that if you don't have a branch in that location, then they're oftentimes looking at unregulated products that may have higher interest rates. And so you do see a shift in not only the number of physical bank branches, but what they actually look like when you walk into them.
And I'm sure that these MDIs are also bringing people from the underbanked into the official banking system, right? I mean, the statistics, at least from a couple years ago, I remember like 30% underbanked of Americans were really eye-opening, right? And I'm sure that the pandemic made things even worse, right? When you look at the statistics of the low amount of kind of emergency funds that people have on hand, just in general, right? Mm-hmm. The community bank plays a very vital role in extending credit where someone might be in a moment of need as an alternative to one of the high interest rate, you know, off banking site alternatives. So,
and the reason why is because of relationship banking, right? When you think of unbanked, underbanked, some of these communities that have, you know, they're more volatile income streams, they really are relying on being able to touch and feel a person, to be able to get that coaching, that technical assistance. And so it is really important that our banks are able to do that customer engagement. But what we're finding is that they've got to be able to be high tech and high touch, right? You've got to be able to service your customer, but you can't just rely on the relationships. You've got to be able to scale that, and technology helps you scale that. And so how do you do that is something that our banks are really wrestling with, it because it's the relationships that allowed them to say yes when traditional lenders may have said no, because we can see, you know, other things that go outside of traditional data points. We're talking to you about those things. And so it's a very interesting shift.
And I'm seeing a lot of, you know, apps like Cash App being used to transmit money. Is that part of the overall digitization that you're seeing? Are there different, not that company in particular, but the ability to send money through different digital platforms seems to be replacing cash in a lot of ways, right? Like if I even LA my car or go anywhere, like people will ask for a digital payment instead of cash, which I appreciate because people seem to be using banks less for the ATMs and more for just, you know, like you said, like getting access to new products or guidance and interfacing with the technology. And the human seems to be like a uniquely 2023 challenge.
It is. There are so many trends when you think about the payments landscape, whether it's what's called peer-to-peer payments, my ability to get on a Zelle or a Venmo or a Cash App and pay somebody else, or it's just paying for a product that I've just purchased online. You know, all of these things, these real-time payments, it's completely changing the landscape. And so there is an acceleration towards digital payments that you're seeing now that you hadn't seen before. And another thing that you're seeing that you hadn't seen before is just adoption by the customer base. You know, customers are really wanting that. And so between the growth of real-time payments and the increased access to customer data points, the expansion of customers' choice, right? How they want to pay, the type of payment methods that they want to use, moving away from the traditional payment methods, the digital currencies changing, right? Stable coins, crypto, all of those things are really accelerating the role and the trends that you're seeing in payments companies. I'm tripping over my words here.
I know. I mean, you're saying crypto, right? And that's an area I think a lot of us are cautious about talking about, but it is, you know, I think the whole FTX meltdown created kind of a sense of pause for a lot of people. Yeah. Like, well, we really have to do our homework on the products. And even if the really smart people who've done their homework in investing some of these companies didn't quite understand it. So I think it sounds like a lot of people have been cautious about dipping their toes into it, but see it as an inevitability. Like, where do you think the MDIs are at? It's probably premature to talk about crypto, but generally maybe stable coins. Is that something you're beginning to educate yourselves on and, you know, at least do some due diligence on?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, it's not about educating or doing due diligence. It's really about innovation is oftentimes outpacing regulations. And right now, this is there's too much regulatory uncertainty. And so even though customers are demanding it, and even though you know that this is where it's going, you really need more regulatory certainty. And so that's something that our banks are really relying on, you know, regulators to do. You're seeing states starting to play a bigger role in terms of stablecoins, but our federal regulators are still trying to figure out in a number of ways. They're still talking about it. I think that you are going to see a lot of movement. It's inevitable, but it's something that you're going to have to figure out, because as next gen money moving technologies are evolving and digital currencies are becoming front and center, our banks are going to have to update their operating models. They're going to have to update their digital infrastructure. They're going to have to update the digital technology so that it can inform payment and really drive payment models. But in order to get there, innovation has really got to keep up with regulation, or vice versa. Really, regulation has got to keep up with innovation.
That resonates so much, because I'm hearing the same from just even institutional investors, right? Like, we mm-hmm. want to get into the space, but without the, you know, regulation in place, we have uncertainty or a lack of clarity. And so there's a lot of kind of capital and investment on the sidelines still mm-hmm. That we're seeing. And I think, you know, what I'm hearing from a lot of people is they don't really care necessarily if it's the SEC or CFTC, but just pick a regulator and do yeah. something rather mm-hmm. than a specific framework. And I'm not speaking on behalf of, you know, anyone in particular, other than that's what I'm getting as a vibe, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just pick something, go forward. I think industry can innovate around whatever regulatory framework is put in place, hopefully, but without any sort of certainty. It's like trying to build a house on quicksand, right? There's yeah. no stability yeah. to build a business model on. And so, you know, it'll be interesting it's to really see if challenging. 2023 is the year of crypto regulation, or if it's just too hard of a nut to crack. But the longer, you know, we wait on that, I get the sense the more you know, people are going to drag their feet. Because you're right, we are, like, I've educated myself on crypto over the past years. I've done my due diligence, and we're waiting for that certainty, right?
Mm-hmm. You are, and we spend a lot of time talking about its implications on payments and its implications for investments. But, you know, digital identity solutions is a big thing as well. You know, so as people are wanting to pay with some of these digital currencies, you've got to be able to make sure that this is the person who they say they are. And so that means what? You've got to collect more data. And when you're collecting more data on customers, then you've got privacy concerns that come up. So there are so many implications that are out there when you're starting to really shift into some of these non-traditional payment methods.
I was speaking to, like, a member of Congress who is a Democrat who is interested in the idea of a driver's license for crypto. And I pressed mm-hmm. further. He said, well, we should have, like, a digital ID. And if we have, you know, if we have payments made, it can be, you need, like, some sort of driver's license to qualify, that you know enough, you've done your homework, you've done your education, and was, like, vague about exactly how it would work. Right. But I think a lot of the privacy implications are interesting. I think back, mm-hmm. like, I have the clear now, right? So I've given up the privacy of my retina scan in order to go through mm-hmm. customs faster, right? Like, is there something I'd give up on my financial privacy in order to be able to have access to lower cost or immediate payment mm-hmm. transmission or access to social benefits that, like, instantly in the future, my social security could come in? There'd be, like, no more social security fraud. So, mm-hmm. and the government would function faster, right? So everything in life is kind of a trade-off between the privacy and then the low cost efficacy, right? And I think 2023 is such an exciting time to be in.
It is.
Because we're kind of, like, in a science ethics club at this point.
Mm-hmm. We are. And, you know, we've talked a lot about technology and digitization and innovation. And I think those are really, really big, important topics. One thing that I think is always so interesting to me as people are talking about digital innovation and how are MDIs dealing with this, it's so interesting because MDIs have always been very innovative. When you think about the way that they have these flexible products and services, the way that they're able to say yes when others are saying no is because they've been innovative in how they approve a loan. They've been innovative in the way that they're doing their lending. But how do you make sure technology is integrated into that is the nut that they're trying to crack, because they haven't really had the ability to do that before, because technology has been so cost prohibitive. They haven't been able to play in that space, but they've always been innovative in how they've lend.
Right, like, now alternative sources of credit. Like, have you paid your utility bills on time, even if you don't
exactly.
have a credit card record, right? That
exactly.
makes so much sense.
The fact that you may not have a mortgage payment, because I understand you're in an area that has a history of redlining, but I can see that you've been very consistent in your rental payments. Those are the types of things. People talk a lot about alternative underwriting, and this is what these banks have always done, but they haven't had the ability to keep up with technology because it's been cost prohibitive.
So I wonder if, I mean, in the future, there will be some alternative to a social security number, not getting rid of it, but some sort of digital, will we have like a retinal social security mm-hmm. number where you just show up with your eyes scanned in a bank and immediately mm-hmm. looking at the eye scan, you know, you can say what you want paid. You don't even need a card anymore. I mean, we're going to be in such a science fiction movie setting and maybe not that many years from now where, yeah. you know, will we have a clear like experience at an MDI, you showing your eyeballs at the teller and then asking mm-hmm. for what you want and having it transmitted through a stablecoin. I mean, this stuff seems like it should be decades away, but it's not that far.
Yeah, it'll be here before you know it. That's for sure.
So interesting. And what else, how are you just keeping up to date on all this? You must be going to so many conferences and hearing like from the newest thought leaders on technology. Like what does your schedule look like in the next couple months if we wanted to hear you speak somewhere? Are you going to Milken again this year or?
I probably will be at Milken again this year. But I, you know, I'm not the expert. So I'm always talking to the experts, whether it is, you know, Chris Brummer, or others. I'm always talking to the experts, always talking to fintechs and obviously the banks themselves to just stay abreast on, you know, where things are at. I would say I spend the most time trying to bridging the gap between academics who have a certain thought process, fintechs who've come up with different solutions, policymakers and the banks themselves. There's oftentimes a gap between reality and what you can really do. And so I do spend a lot of time trying to close those gaps.
I mean, I'm translating my technology of like automated trading to the masses. Mm-hmm. And it does feel sometimes like you're speaking two different languages and you're translating into almost vernacular the tech speak.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining. This has been so enlightening and so exciting. It's such an exciting time to be focused on this. So I just can't wait to hear what you've been up to in a couple months from now and hope you can come on again.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I appreciate the time to talk about some of these issues because we don't really think about how innovation impacts things like physical branch presence or payments or automated lending and how AI supports all of those things and how customers are becoming more and more connected and wanting to do those things. At the same time, they have privacy concerns. So it's a very interesting topic. So look forward to continuing this conversation with you, Kirsten.
Yeah, I can't wait. Well, there you have it. A big thanks to Nicole for coming on the pod and a big thanks to you for tuning in. Talk soon.